Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an assessment of what is widely seen as a strategic blunder and foreign policy malpractice by President Trump, who yesterday tore up an agreement which the U.S. signed together with the permanent members of the U.N. Security Council and Germany, just as Trump is poised to sign another agreement with North Korea. Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, the former Chief of Staff of Secretary of State Colin Powell, who now teaches at the College of William and Mary and has an article at the American Conservative, Gina Haspel and How Torture Deceived Us into Iraq, joins us. In the absence of any alternative policy or rational explanation for such a destabilizing and unnecessary act, we will discuss how much Trump is motivated by spite in undoing his predecessor's achievements following his racist campaign of hatred towards Barack Obama, whose birth certificate and legitimacy Trump rose to political prominence questioning. Or could it be Trump's own ego-driven, exaggerated sense of fulfilling his campaign promises, no matter how ridiculous, at the expense of U.S. national security and global peace? With Iran now free to pursue nuclear weapons as the U.S. moves away from diplomacy towards military confrontation, are the leaders of Israel and Saudi Arabia hoping to draw the U.S. into fighting a war against Iran on their behalf? Then, with Gina Haspel, Trump's nominee to head up the CIA, refusing to say in Senate testimony today that the torture program she was involved in was morally wrong, we will speak with Stephen Saltz, an anti-torture advisor with Physicians for Human Rights, who is the co-founder of the Coalition for an Ethical Psychology and was a dissident psychologist inside the American Psychological Association who opposed their collaboration with the Bush-Cheney torture regime. We will discuss America's ill-fated journey to the dark side and how torture does not work. Then finally, we'll speak with David Farris, a professor of political science at Roosevelt University and the author of a new book just out, It's Time to Fight Dirty, How Democrats Can Build a Lasting Majority in American Politics. He joins us to discuss how Democrats have got to battle for democracy as vigorously as Republicans fight for power and undo voter suppression, reverse gerrymandering, and stop the capture of the courts by Federalist Society's reactionaries by winning electoral power, then using it to carry out the will of the majority. And joining us now is Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who is the former Chief of Staff to United States Secretary of State Colin Powell. In 2005, he went public with his knowledge that Vice President Cheney had provided the guidance that led to America's torture disgrace at Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and elsewhere. He currently teaches courses at the College of William & Mary and George Washington University, and he has an article at the American Conservative, Gina Haspel and How Torture Deceived Us into Iraq. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lawrence Wilkerson.
Good to be with you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Colonel Wilkerson. And obviously, I want to talk about your article on Gina Haspel, who tested me today, I'd like to discuss with you. But let's start with what happened yesterday. In my opening, I'm expressing my own puzzlement as why would you, you know, there's an old expression, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. What's your understanding of why this happened?
I think the German foreign minister several weeks ago summed it up quite well. He said, this is not based on international policy, security, foreign or otherwise. It's based on domestic needs. And I think he's right. I think Trump made a promise to his base, and that base now got the promise fulfilled. So there may be other reasons, too. You intimated a couple that President Trump wants to reverse anything that President Obama did. I think that's a valid observation. But I think the German foreign minister is right. This is strictly based on domestic political concerns. And those concerns are Trump's base in keeping them titillated, more or less.
Right, but all politicians make promises during campaigns, and the more exaggerated ones they quickly abandon. That's reality. I mean, building a wall and getting Mexico to pay for it.
That's... Yeah, but most politicians, particularly those elected to the White House, have a mandate. They have a majority of the American people on their side. Donald Trump has never had that. So he's got to be very careful with the 40, 41, 42, 35, whatever it is on any given day, percent of America that actually voted for him. He's got to keep every single one of them in his camp. So living up to his campaign promises is more important for him than it would be for, say, a president who'd gotten a rather large political mandate to rule. He didn't. Hillary Clinton won the popular vote.
So, in other words, we have a tyranny of the minority.
Yeah, absolutely. Something that the founders talked about, something that de Tocqueville talked about, something that we talk about in my seminars. What does it mean to have special interests running this country? Because that is precisely what we have.
Well, do we have a special interests in the sense that, you know, foreign policy has not normally been dictated by plutocratic donors? But you've got the Koch brothers, backers of Mike Pompeo, and then you've got the neocon and pro-Israel AIPAC people, particularly the casino owner Sheldon Adelson, who apparently pushed for John Bolton to get the job, as he is now right at President Bush's right hand, President Trump's right hand as the national security advisor. So, is that a campaign promise fulfilled? In other words, the powerful plutocrats picking their important positions.
Well, you're talking about two different issues here. When you're talking about the oligarchs of this country and you're talking about Donald Trump's domestic base, they're two entirely
right.
different issues. In fact, they're different people. I think what we're looking at here, more clearly than anything else, though, given the German foreign minister's comment and the fact that I think that's correct with regard to the president, you're looking at people arrayed around the president, some of whom you've just mentioned, that have different agendas. And with this president, as with my president in 2002 and 3, George W. Bush, they have a rank amateur. I know he thinks he's a deal maker. I know he thinks he's a good businessman. I don't know how you're a good businessman when you've been bankrupt more than you've been successful. But nonetheless, he's managed to portray that image primarily through television and his reality TV show. But when you have a president who is so unsteeped in anything with regard to foreign or security policy, then the people around him become awfully important. People like Nikki Haley at the UN, people like John Bolton as National Security Advisor, people like Jim Mattis and John Kelly, they become very important people. So what you have right now is you have a confluence of personalities directing U.S. policy, and the most powerful personality of all is not even an American. It's Bibi Netanyahu. And the prospect of a unanimity on the American domestic political scene with regard to Israel is quite high. Most Americans, for example, don't even know. I've been in all 50 states in the past 6-7 years. I was in 12 states in the last month or so. Not a single solitary American whom I asked the question knew that we now, very carefully and secretly, have stood up a U.S. military base in Israel. This is something that the military, during my entire 31 years in service, vehemently recommended against. The political authority in this country, president after president, agreed that we would never, never put a U.S. military base in Israel. It's untenable. You've got hundreds of millions of Arabs and others who are opposed to Israel surrounding Israel. You would never put a U.S. military base in Israel. Only in extremists would you even land U.S. troops in Israel. So we've just put a base in Israel, a base with the Stars and Stripes flying over. Why did we do that? And why did we do it so secretly that no Americans know about it? Well, we did it because when those Hezbollah rockets rain in on Israel now, one or two of them are probably going to hit our base. And if they don't hit our base, someone will make sure they hit our base. And then the president will turn to the Congress and he will say, we have had troops on the ground in Israel struck by Iran or by Hezbollah or by Hamas or by Syria or whomever we want to fight that day, and then we'll be sucked in because no U.S. president will be unable to get the Congress to overwhelmingly approve a reaction if we're hit and we're hit in Israel. So this is all happening, and no one's paying any attention, and I'm not even sure Donald Trump is paying any attention.
So now we're talking about the tail of the dog. wagging the dog, in the sense that we already have we had a rocket exchange on Tuesday night. The Israelis rained rockets down on an Iranian IRGC base just south of Damascus, and now 20 or so Iranian rockets have rained down on the Golan Heights. And I imagine what you're saying is that the U.S. military are somewhere in that neighborhood. But in my opening, I made the suggestion, and I find it extraordinary that we could ever get to a situation. We know how much Bibi Netanyahu wants a war with Iran. We know how much John Bolton does. I don't know about Pompeo, and I assume that the only adult in the room there is Mattis. But on the Saudi side, MBS, soon to be the king, the boy king, if you will, he's made it really clear. He's equated the Iranian regime to Adolf Hitler. So they would both. Is this what's going on, that they're basically going to gin up a war or trip into a war or blunder into a war, drag us in and have our boys and girls fight for Netanyahu and MBS?
I think you've struck something there. I think you've struck gold. The saying in the military right now, in the ranks, is that the Saudis are willing to defend their kingdom and fight Iran to the last dead American. I think that's pretty appropriate because that's essentially what it is. I don't think Israel is in that desperate a situation, but let's look at Israel for a few minutes. They are competent militarily. They are probably the best military in the region, but they don't have a power projection capability, so their taking on Iran would be extremely difficult. They'd either have to move armored forces with artillery and other supporting arms through Syria and thus subject themselves to all kinds of flanking attacks from Hamas and Hezbollah and the Quds Force, the IRGC, and others, or they would have to go by air, and that would be almost prohibitive for them because they just don't have enough air. So Israel, in this case, can't bring its military might to bear against Iran. The only way you can do that is with the U.S. leading the way. So you have on both sides people who want to fight Iran and want to use the United States to do so.
But why fight Iran when that government is teetering in terms of its own constituents, the young, the women?
Excellent question. I mean, all bombing Iran will do, all fighting Iran will do, all invading Iran will do is take 75 million people in a country four or five times as big as Iraq, a country with strategic depth unparalleled, a country with incredibly difficult terrain. It's not deserts like Iraq is. Very difficult country to fight in, and solidify them. Solidify them around hatred for the attacker, whether it's Israel, the United States, or both, hatred for that attacker. And so you think Iraq was bad? Look at Iran. It'll be a 10-year war, cost $3 to $4 trillion. We'll have to put 500,000 troops on the ground in Iran. That means we have to bring conscription back because we don't have that many troops. It will be a horrible conflict. At the end of a decade, we will spend all that blood and treasure, and it won't look any different from Iraq today. It'll look worse, probably.
But the Iranians have apparently pre-positioned lots of rockets on the northern tier of the Gulf, and they are all aimed at Abqaiq and all of the Saudi oil facilities. So, and we know how volatile the situation is in the Straits of Hormuz. A couple of those speedboats of the IRGC could, even Trump himself said, warned them not to get near our beautiful warships. There's all kinds of triggers there. And even if the U.S. and Iran don't really want a war, we're in a situation where the Houthi proxies could, one of their missiles could get through and kill a bunch of Saudis. Eric Prince, the mercenary army, he's there in the Gulf. God knows what mischief he could get up to. Is that really the problem here? Even if the dire scenario that you just laid out doesn't happen, there are so many triggers in that volatile region that something could happen that really the U.S. and Iran may not want, even if Netanyahu and MBS want it.
No, that's very true. The proximity of naval forces alone is concerning, especially when we don't really have a serious incident at sea agreement like we have with the Soviets, for example, during the duration of the Cold War. But here's the reality of the situation so long as the United States doesn't try to effect regime change. Iran cannot project power in any significant sort of way. The United States could clear the Strait of Hormuz in a matter of 48 hours. The United States could clear the Persian Gulf, could clear the Northern Sea of Oman. Indeed, everything around there that's strategic, whether it's Ras Tanura and its 6 million barrel per day production capacity or whatever, the United States could secure from offshore. It would not need to put major forces on the ground. That means that, as we did in Operation Praying Mantis and Operation Earnest Will in 1988, we could attack Iran with air power, and primarily air power from carrier battle groups in the northern Oman Sea, and we could do whatever damage we wanted to do that would be defensive. And I emphasize that, defensive. That is to say, it would keep them from doing anything to the oil network in Saudi Arabia, anything to the strait or mining the sea or whatever. We could do that. But the moment we put our foot on shore and we go into the offense and we solidify those 75 million people in that country, we are in a different war. We're in a different context. And they have the advantage in that context, whether it's asymmetric responses, guerrilla warfare, or whatever, they have the advantage. They can wreak havoc on us. So that's the reason for half a century our strategy was one of offshore balancing. We didn't put forces on the ground. We kept them at sea, and when we needed to do something, we did it, as we did in the first Gulf War, for example. The change in what we're doing now is seriously inhibiting us. It's not leaving us any flexibility. We're committed when we do the kinds of things we've done. Look at the fleet headquarters we have in Bahrain. It's the largest fleet headquarters in the U.S. Navy. Look at the Al Udeid Air Base we have in Qatar. It's the largest air base in the world. Look at the one we have in seven bases we have in Saudi Arabia. Look at the logistics facilities we have in Kuwait and everything. We have invested heavily in that region now. We probably have 50,000 troops there right now. We don't have that many troops in our armed forces anymore. They're very small. The all-volunteer force is having an extraordinary recruiting problems. We can't even recruit to the levels that Trump wants to with regard to the Navy, the Air Force, and the Army. So this is not a good thing for us to be doing, committing major forces on the ground in this region, whether it's in Iran, Syria, or wherever. So as long as we stay offshore, as long as we do things that are defensive, that is to say defending our right to the oil, defending our Saudi Arabia's right to its oil, and so forth and so on, we're in pretty safe ground. But the moment we start trying to change regimes and to put major forces on the ground in order to do that, we're in trouble.
Well, but back to the fact that this regime is deeply unpopular with its own people, that the young, the educated, the urban, and the women are opposed to it. They've just shut down social media. Kids are furious. They're taking to the streets. The Iranian population recently found out how much money the government, the hardliners, the IRGC, Quds, and the supreme leader are spending on Hezbollah and in Syria. They're furious. They want to be taken care of. Their economy stalled. The investment hasn't come in.
You're describing everything that is ripe for revolution.
Exactly.
An internal revolution. One that the United States should keep its dirty, filthy hands off of and allow the Iranian people to effect and allow the Iranian people to change that government in Tehran.
Right, and the worst, the stupidest thing we could do is undercut the moderate leadership, empower the hardliners, and hang the young, hopeful Iranians out to dry.
Yeah, and the moment we bomb them or attack them, those young Iranians will change their mind about us.
Sure. Well, just in the last minute, because I did mention your article, Gina Haspel, and how torture deceived us into Iraq. Is there a quick couple of minute summary you can give on the article?
Gina Haspel is the absolutely wrong person to put in charge of the CIA. The first reason is a bureaucratic reason. You never want to put someone in charge of the Central Intelligence Agency who has been in its bowels, so to speak, for 33 years, let alone in its covert operations. She's not an analyst. She's a covert operator. She talks people into betraying their own country for money or worse. That's what her whole career has been. You never want to put someone like that in charge of the CIA. The second thing is she lied. The third thing is she destroyed evidence. And the fourth thing she did was, you know, we punished the Nazis at Nuremberg for using the defense of I was just following orders. She even sort of intimated that today in her hearing that she was following orders. She was following orders. She did this. She did that. She was following orders. That's not a defense when you're breaking the law. And she was breaking the law. The people involved in the torture program, let me say it as forcefully as I can, were breaking the law. International law, the UNCAT, the UN Convention Against Torture, which we worked on, we led the path to, we signed, and then as a provision of signing that treaty, we made our domestic law conform to that treaty, so she broke U.S. law, too, as did all those other people, including John Brennan, who defended her. John Brennan was up to this in his neck, to his neck. And one of the things I'll accuse President Obama of doing that was absolutely stupid was making John Brennan the director of the CIA. And making Gina Haspel the director would be even worse than that. So those are the reasons I oppose her.
Well, Lawrence Wilkerson, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Truly. Thank you.
Thank you again. I've been speaking with Lawrence Wilkerson, who is a retired United States Army colonel and former chief of staff to United States Secretary of State Colin Powell. In 2005, he went public with his knowledge that Vice President Cheney had provided the guidance that led to America's torture disgrace at Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and elsewhere. He currently teaches courses at the College of William & Mary and George Washington University, and he has an article at the American Conservative, Gina Haspel and How Torture Deceived Us into Iraq. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking with the author of a new book just out, It's Time to Fight Dirty, How Democrats Can Build a Lasting Majority in American Politics. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with an anti-torture advisor with Physicians for Human Rights who will explain why torture does not work.
Time and time we see these acts against humanity. While each for each and each world leader shed blood for what they each believe. On and on and on we go. Well, some will you see and some won't be. True for you and truth will lead you to a sense of heart. Well, now.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Stephen Saltz, who's an anti-torture advisor with Physicians for Human Rights, who is the director of the Center for Research, Evaluation, and Program Development at the Boston Graduate School of Psychoanalysis and the co-founder of the Coalition for an Ethical Psychology. He's one of two dissident psychologists inside the American Psychological Association who opposed their collaboration with the Bush-Cheney torture regime, which was exposed in the scathing Hoffman Report. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Saltz.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us. And what did you make of the testimony today by Gina Haspel, who is the President Trump's nominee to be the new Director of Central Intelligence? She was asked an awful lot of questions about the torture regime that she was involved in, both at a black site and in destroying tapes of torture conducted during the Bush-Cheney administration. The thing that struck me was that while she kept emphasizing that the CIA would not torture again and that they did not want to resume or revive any such programs, she still would not repudiate or would not comment on the morality of torture and therefore repudiated.
Exactly. But I would back up a bit because I think the bigger problem is that we're even having these hearings. That someone who is known to have participated in the torture program could even be considered for director of the CIA is a sad commentary on how far how low the country has fallen and how the respect for human rights has declined. It should be unimaginable that she would be considered as director.
Well, but the person who's considering her and putting a nomination forth is President Donald Trump, who himself has been a cheerleader for torture. He makes no bones about the fact that he would like to bring back torture, and he's almost championed it and certainly praised it.
Yeah, and as have the majority of the Republican Party, unfortunately, with the exception of Senator McCain. And yeah, but that's a comment on our country that we are here. And as you said, she said, we're not going to return to torture, to the enhanced interrogations. I don't believe she called it torture. But she refused to condemn it as immoral. And she also didn't say that it was a failure. In fact, she rather defended it.
Well, the other Republican is going to vote against her, of course, is Rand Paul. I don't know whether his objections are moral or something to do with his libertarian position on international relations.
I believe that he thinks that torture is wrong.
Oh, so he's with McCain then.
I disagree with him on many things, but on this one, this one he gets credit.
Okay. Now, I just wanted to make sure that he was on the same page as John McCain. I'm trying to be fair to the Republicans. At least another Republican, right, is on the record being against torture and therefore will not vote for Gina Haspel to be the next director of Central Intelligence. Of course, the person who lobbied heavily for the job is Senator Tom Cotton. And apparently the outgoing head of the CIA, who is now the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, he apparently told Trump or recommended to Trump that Gina Haspel should have the job. So given that choice, could we have done worse with Tom Cotton?
Probably. It's hard to know in these circumstances. And it partly depends on whether you think that a modicum of competence in the area is a good idea or a bad idea. Gina Haspel, from all accounts, has at least some competence in intelligence work. Tom Cotton is not especially noted for that.
Well, but that, I think, is the irony here that some Republicans are pointing out. One, they are perfectly happy to have the Democrats vote against a woman. But two, some of their spokespeople are saying, well, you know, the Democrats have complained about the competence of many of the people that the Trump administration has put forward, given, of course, some of the outrageous cabinet appointees like Ben Carson at HUD and Scott Pruitt at the EPA. Here you have a woman with, I think, 36 years of experience in the CIA, and you're voting against her. Do you think that's a message that's going to work?
Probably not. At least one Democrat said that he'll vote for, and I think that probably gives them the votes to pass it.
Right. That's Senator Manchin of West Virginia.
Yes. Yeah. So she's probably going to get confirmed unless there's another Republican somewhere who hasn't spoken up.
Right.
But it's a real sad commentary. And it's also sad how much of the intelligence community has backed her. People who nominally are against torture still backed her, a lot of them. Though there is a significant faction who have not, and it's important to recognize them. And ex-CIA and ex-intelligence agents of other agencies who have come out strongly against her. For example, Mark Fallon, who was deputy director of the Navy Criminal Investigative Service, has been adamant against her, as have a number of former CIA staff.
So the expectation is then that she will be, will it be as narrow as the vote for Pompeo was? Pompeo really went out of his way to court the Democrats. And as you probably recall, it was again Senator Rand Paul who opposed him and then at the last minute switched his vote on the assurance that Pompeo recognized that the Iraq War was a mistake, which is, I think, hardly a great concession in the light of history. But that was a tight vote. What do you think this vote will be?
It'll be tight. I mean, it looks like the vast majority of Democrats are going to vote against her. I don't know if one or two of the others, especially once they figure it's a done deal, may switch those who are running for re-election in states which Trump won. There may be a couple of them who, like Manchin, will also switch to vote. So there may be a couple of votes, but it'll be close. But I think she's in. On the other hand, at least the whole discussion has said that no, we haven't just put this behind us, and the forces that think that torture is both an abomination and a strategic disaster for the country are not being silent.
And again, I'm speaking with Stephen Saltz, who's an anti-torture advisor with Physicians for Human Rights, who is the director of the Center for Research, Evaluation, and Program Development at the Boston Graduate School of Psychoanalysis and the co-founder of the Coalition for an Ethical Psychology. He is one of two dissident psychologists inside the American Psychological Association who opposed their collaboration with the Bush-Cheney torture regime, which was exposed in the scathing Hoffman report. Let's just go back to that for the benefit of the audience, that it's an extraordinarily disgraceful story in many ways. It's a sort of not just about the loss of any kind of moral foundation in this country and going to the dark side, as Dick Cheney said. It's also an example, I think, of the sort of corrupt boondoggles, the Nigeria on the Potomac, as some people describe Washington, where these contractors make out like bandits. And these two so-called experts that they hired, psychologists who ran this torture program, got paid a ton of money. And all they did, I think, was recycle old kind of documents or whatever from the Korean War torture program. Was that your understanding of what happened there? The long and the short of it was, the whole program was a disaster, not just morally, but in practical military terms. Very little intelligence, if any, was gleaned.
Just before I get to that, I just want to correct one thing. When you say there were two psychologists dissidents in the APA, there were many dissidents in the APA. Two of us met with the board when the so-called Hoffman report was about to be released, but we were representatives of many others. I don't want to take credit away from all the other people involved. But now that I've corrected that, let's get back to... So these guys, James Mitchell and Bruce Jessen, who were recently retired Army military psychologists who were hired as contractors from the CIA, and their firm was paid $81 million, we learned from the Senate Intelligence Committee report, to basically torture people and train others how to torture people. How much they made personally is a bit unclear because they did have a company, so some of the money went to other people, et cetera, but they did quite well at a minimum. Yeah, it's been very sad commentary on the psychology profession that this could have occurred. Your question got about this. Did they retread? It's exactly what they were doing, where this came from. It's a bit complicated. Yes, there is a long history of U.S. torture. And during the 1960s, 50s, 60s, and early 70s, there was a massive research program involving literally billions of dollars in today's dollars, which to study effective interrogation, including in torture techniques, and this resulted in the so-called Kubark Manual that has a chapter on coercive interrogations and then was later exported to various dictatorships in Latin America who were trained with another manual, the Human Resource Exploitation Manual, that taught these abusive techniques. And as you mentioned, a lot of this was derived from those used during the Korean War by U.S. opponents, by Korea and before that by brainwashers in Eastern Europe. And then it became incorporated in the military SEER program, the Survival Evasion Resistance Escape, which subjected military members who were at high risk of capture by powers that wouldn't respect the Geneva Conventions. In other words, powers that would torture. So they were subjected to small amounts of torture in order to try and inoculate them from breaking down, so they'd have some sense of what they might experience and some feeling that they could survive it. that's where Mitchell and Jessen worked. They were psychologists with this SEER program, and then they took these techniques and basically turned them into torture techniques, which is what they were never designed for in the U.S. They didn't, but they had a new sort of theoretical patina, something called learned helplessness, developed by psychologist Martin Seligman of the University of Pennsylvania. So they had a slightly different theoretical foundation than had been used earlier, but it was basically the same idea. Unfortunately for the U.S., in addition to being immoral, it also doesn't work particularly well.
Well, and it certainly didn't, but they made a lot of money. But just in closing, I recall that General Mattis had told Trump that he was opposed to torture. And I remember Trump saying, you know, I just talked to General Mattis about it, and he said that what works better than torturing a prisoner is offering them a beer. So maybe the general is right. But it looks as if Mattis's advice to Trump didn't last very long or had a very short shelf life.
Yeah. But what veteran interrogators tell us, I'm not an interrogator, but I have talked to many, is that what you need to do is build a relationship with a person that when someone is captured, they're anxious. They want to talk to somebody. The job of the interrogator is to be the person that they want to talk to. That's what General Mattis means by giving them a beer. Obviously, with Muslims, a beer may not be the best technique. But basically, making them comfortable is what you want to do, because that's how you get them to talk. And it's exactly the opposite. By right. torturing people, by making them very stressed, you make them not want to talk.
Right. Well, you know, it's manly man, do manly things. I think that it's
yeah.
just stupid macho nonsense. I thank you for joining us, Stephen Saltz. It's an interesting conversation. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Stephen Saltz, who's an anti-torture advisor with Physicians for Human Rights, who is the director of the Center for Research Evaluation and Program Development at the Boston Graduate School of Psychoanalysis and co-founder of the Coalition for an Ethical Psychology. He's one of two dissident psychologists inside the American Psychological Association who opposed their collaboration with the Bush-Cheney torture regime, which was exposed in the scathing Hoffman Report. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, David Farris, a professor of political science at Roosevelt University in Chicago and a regular contributor to The Week. He's the author of Dissent and Revolution in a Digital Age, Social Media, Blogging, and Activism in Egypt, and the co-editor of Social Media in Iran, Politics and Society after 2009. And his latest book just out is It's Time to Fight Dirty, How Democrats Can Build a Lasting Majority in American Politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Farris.
Thanks so much for having me on the show, Ian.
Well, thank you, David. And let's start with the dilemma that the Democrats have at the moment, and that is whether or not to emphasize impeachment. On the one hand, it seems to be an issue that activates the Democratic base, but already the Republicans, and including Donald Trump, are using that as a weapon against the Democrats by saying to the electorate that if you elect the Democrats, all they're going to do is impeach me. They have no plan beyond that. They don't have a positive program. They just want to remove me and reverse the last election that they lost. So what's your sense of how that should be played in terms of fighting back, if not fighting dirty?
Well, sure. I mean, I would respond to that by saying, you know, I think we can walk and chew gum at the same time here. You know, I think that the National Party has a pretty robust platform that they're running on right now, including changes to the healthcare system and family and medical leave and inequality. I expect the individual candidates probably to emphasize those issues, particularly in the races for the House of Representatives. But I don't think there's any reason that they can't also call for the president's impeachment. And I think that they should do that, not necessarily because it's a winning electoral issue, but because I think the president really should be impeached. I think he's committed multiple impeachable offenses already. I think he's a very dangerous man. And so I think that the sort of impeachment bit may get some of the base out, and I think some of the policy platform may reach some of those suburban Republican voters that they need to flip the House. So I don't think those two things are mutually exclusive at all. And I do think that there's some thinking that has to take place about what to emphasize and where. But I really think we can do both.
So you don't believe then that reaching out to the center is an important part of winning back the House and possibly the Senate? Because that's the argument, is that disaffected Republicans, it's not a winning argument to win them over, that all you care about is getting rid of this guy as opposed to fixing up the country.
Sure. I mean, I think that it should be up to some of the individual candidates in the most important races. You know, I think some of those races are going to look like Connor Lamb's district in Pennsylvania. I don't necessarily think it's in Connor Lamb's best interest to run on an impeachment platform and to make that the key issue in his race. But I do think that there are other races where impeachment will turn out the vote. And so I think the National Party has to focus on sort of obstructing Trump's agenda, slowing that legislation down, highlighting the abuses of power. And I think that the Trump administration is doing a lot of the work for us by being so venal and so incompetent that, you know, the president is deeply unpopular. And I think there's an extent to which that unpopularity is already baked in to the midterm results, and we just kind of have to let it happen. So again, I think that there's room to emphasize different policy issues and different ideas in different districts for the House of Representatives. And then I think the National Party, which it largely has done, I think, since the election, should remain focused on keeping the caucus together and preventing the worst things from happening.
So are some of the assumptions, though, that are out there correct? The longest-term assumption has always been that we need to get more people to vote. And certainly in countries like Australia, where it's compulsory to vote, you do have really better outcomes because 90-something, 99% vote. And therefore, even the right-wing politicians have to present family-friendly, worker-friendly programs because the majority votes. And that's the nature of social democracy. You elect people to government who are good stewards of your tax money and in return provide you with government services. We have sort of lost sight of that in this country. We vote over guns and abortion and all kinds of extraneous things. But there still is an assumption that if you get more people to vote, they'll vote on the left. And I'm beginning to wonder whether that's a false assumption because, for example, Donald Trump is going up in the polls in spite of the manifest incompetence and reckless nature of him, particularly his act yesterday to move away from one of the few diplomatic achievements that the US and the world have managed. So moving away from diplomacy towards war, and at the same time he's mired and more mired in scandal, yet he's going up in the polls. So what's happening out there? Is this country coarsening? Does that old adage that nice guys finish last, is that becoming the rules of the road?
Well, I mean, I don't necessarily think so, although I do think Democrats need to fight smarter and more ruthlessly to gain power than to maintain it. I mean, I think if you look at the president's approval numbers, yeah, sure, they're up a bit over the last couple of months, but they're still historically low for this point in a president's term, and they've been historically low the entire time. So I think there's an extent to which you know, he may be in a better position than he was in December, but I think that he still, you know, has about 56-60% of the country against him. And that's really remarkable. And I want to return to this question of voting because I think it's really, really important. You mentioned that, you know, we do see higher turnout rates in other countries, particularly in Europe and Australia. There's a lot of different ways to increase turnout. I talk about some of them in the book. And I think a lot of them are amenable to a national law. So that national law, I call it the Modern Voting Rights Act, would eliminate felony disenfranchisement laws. It would create automatic voter registration policies. We'd declare the Tuesday general election a national holiday, and we'd eliminate these voter ID laws. And, you know, I don't have a percentage for you in terms of how much that would increase the vote in the United States, but non-voters are really, they're like the white whale of American politics, you know. 90 million eligible voters sat out the 2016 election, and that's just, you know, that's crazy. So, you know, we don't know for sure who those people would vote for if they voted, but we do know a couple of things, okay? In the United States, the more educated you are and the older you are, the more likely you are to vote. The richer you are, the more likely you are to vote. So we do know that the pool of non-voters in this country is largely comprised of sort of poor, less educated, marginalized people. And I'm pretty confident that those people would break disproportionately for Democrats if they ever did turn out to vote. So I think that revisiting our voting policies with a really big, you know, if Democrats come into power in 2018 and 2020, I think there's going to be this great opportunity to pass a sweeping national voting law that will boost turnout maybe 5 or 10% in the following election. And I think that would really redound to the Democrats' benefit. Yeah, I don't think it's an accident also. You mentioned these European countries that have better social welfare systems. I mean, I don't think it's an accident that even in places like France and the Netherlands and Germany, the right-wing parties are more committed to public goods and the provision of services to citizens than the Republican Party is in the United States. And again, I think you're absolutely right. That has a lot to do with the fact that more people vote there, there's more voters to answer to, and they want these policies.
So the disparity then, which is what you bring up in your book, David, is that the left basically has to focus on a battle for democracy, and they got to fight as ruthlessly as the right fights for power. And we do have, of course, in the White House, we've got a bully who's willing to use any means to win. So there is this notion that if you play by the rules, you're a sucker. And that's something that I'm not entirely sure about. But the part about it that I get, and I think is an imperative, is that the structures of democracy are under attack. The rule of law is under attack. Believe it or not, the Republicans used to be the party of law and order. But this guy, because he's so damn guilty, is attacking the people who could put him in jail, which are the FBI and the Department of Justice, and yet the Republicans are enablers of not only a mobbed-up criminal, but somebody that might well be committing treason. So it's an extraordinary situation we're in. So let's deal with that first disparity. Is the left required to fight for democracy itself and the structures of democracy and restore them with the same vigor that the right fights for power? And of course, that goes back to the 2010 census, and we got another census coming up in 2020.
Sure, absolutely. You know, I don't recommend that Democrats do things that are illegal, you know, or immoral. But what I do think is that a lot of the formal and informal structures of American democracy are really tilted against the Democratic Party. You know, one good example of that is the U.S. Senate, where the sort of equal representation that's required in the Constitution of all the states means that small and rural states have disproportionate power in the Senate. So right now there's probably 31 Republican-leaning states and 19 Democratic-leaning states, maybe 30, 20, if we're being optimistic. And that means, you know, that we're starting off sort of every race for the Senate, you know, down two touchdowns. That is that the way that the rules are set up right now really benefits the Republican coalition. And so what I recommend in the book is using perfectly legal and perfectly constitutional procedures and maneuvers to rectify that imbalance, you know, which is, you know, the kind of procedural hardball that we've seen the Republicans play over the last 20 or 30 years, you know, not confirming Merrick Garland to the Supreme Court, holding up more judicial nominees between 2009 and 2013 than had ever been held up in the history of the United States. You know, Republicans are pushing against the boundaries of constitutionality, but they're right in the sense that nothing that they've done procedurally has been illegal, at least until Donald Trump took office. And so I recommend, you know, we have to look at the way that our structures are imbalanced, the way that they benefit Republicans, even in a neutral partisan environment. And for the Senate, you know, that means statehood for D.C., statehood for Puerto Rico, right? That's four Democratic senators right there, six or seven Democratic members of Congress in all likelihood. I like to say, if we had made D.C. and Puerto Rico states a long time ago, Democrats would hold the Senate right now. There'd be real investigations of President Trump coming out of Congress. George W. Bush would never have been president, right? So there's all these sort of secondary benefits of doing this, in addition to the fact that it's the right thing to do. Right?
And Puerto Rico, by the way, would not be without power and absolutely ravaged by neglect.
Absolutely, absolutely. I have an idea in the book. I think we should go even further than that, which is we have a lot of progressive power and energy bottled up in the state of California right now. The 38 million people of California have the same two senators as the 700,000 people of Wyoming. And I think that that's unjust. I think it calls for revisiting our arrangements and creating new states, breaking up California into seven pieces. That's not a month one project in the same way that D.C. and Puerto Rico or the Modern Voting Rights Act would be. But I do think the Democrats need to think really long and really hard about how to even the playing field moving forward with Republicans. Otherwise, we're never going to get progressive policy change in this country if Republicans hold the Senate more often than not. And it's a huge problem.
And, of course, there was some bipartisanship for the longest time, and Democrats and Republicans actually, you know, knew each other and knew each other's families and went to each other's birthday parties, etc. And that all ended with Gingrich and his slash-and-burn attitude. And then, of course, that led to the impeachment of Bill Clinton. And then, of course, later we had the Supreme Court handing the presidency to George W. Bush again. And then, of course, all these voter ID laws, the Supreme Court getting rid of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, and then culminating with all the 2010 gerrymandering that took place after the Republicans took all the state legislatures and governorships, and then culminating in the Merrick Garland fiasco. And now, of course, we have the hard, hideous truth that Donald Trump has been the most successful president ever in getting people to the court. It's just running literally a production line from the Federalist Society straight into the U.S. Court of Appeals, a very important appeals court. He's got stacked that now with real right-wing corporatists, reactionaries. So a lot of damage is being done. So your book is very welcome. So
thank you.
But you're saying we got to get people back on the courts. What about, what can we do before they reached a critical mass of the reactionaries taking over, which was the case in the 1920s?
Sure. I'm glad you brought that up, because the courts are probably the dirtiest idea I have in this book. But again, I don't think of it as fighting dirty. I think of it as rectifying an injustice and rectifying a problem with our political order. I recommend that when Democrats get back into power, that they add seats to the Supreme Court and they embark on a radical expansion of federal judiciary, partly to undo some of what President Trump is doing right now, but also because the way that the Supreme Court works is pretty unfair. It's kind of a lottery. And there was a longstanding sort of bipartisan norm that when a seat opened up on the Supreme Court, the president gets to fill it. Doesn't matter when that opening happens, the president gets to fill it. And that's the big norm that Republicans threw away when they blocked the nomination of Merrick Garland to the Supreme Court in 2016. And to me, you know, there's no functional difference between stealing the swing seat on the Supreme Court and packing the Supreme Court. And I look at it, you know, from a moral perspective, too. If you go, Democrats have won the popular vote in six of the last seven presidential elections. If you add up all the votes for the U.S. Senate since 1992, Democrats have scored 30 million more votes. And that, to me, says Democrat, you know, the country wants Democrats staffing the courts, and they haven't gotten to do that. And I think that justifies some pretty ruthless hardball, because the Constitution doesn't say how many justices there are on the Supreme Court. There have been 10. There have been 7. The number used to change in the 19th century. It doesn't have anything to say about the composition of the lower courts. And we haven't added a circuit since the 1980s. And I think there's a caseload argument for that. But there's also a sort of like people have voted to have Democrats do this, and they haven't gotten to do it. I do think if we're going to do this, just in the interest of long-term democracy, I do think Republicans should be offered a truce. And that truce would be a constitutional amendment that would end lifetime tenure on the Supreme Court and guarantee every president the right to nominate two justices per four-year term. There's a law that comes out of a D.C.-based organization called Fix the Court that I think would be magical for our politics. It would really lower the stakes and lower the temperature around these appointments. And I think, you know, in the interests of sort of morality and ethics, we ought to offer this compromise first. I don't think Republicans will go for it. And that, to me, you know, justifies hitting right back, sort of returning the favor for Merrick Garland, packing the courts, and, you know, you worry about the consequences later. Because what's going to happen if we don't do this is that in all likelihood, a 5-4 conservative majority on the court, or even a 63, depending on what happens in the next 2 years, is going to smack down initiative after initiative from the next unified Democratic government in D.C. People are going to get tired of that really quickly. So I think FDR had the right idea in the 1930s, and I think that just sort of the threat of that might bring Republicans to the table for a broader compromise.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, you know, the Liberals really had a lot of power in this country up until, particularly in the 1970s. They controlled the Senate, the House, and had a vast margin on the Supreme Court with real liberals like William O. Douglas and Thurgood Marshall, not the centrists that on this court that we call liberals because the courts moved so far to the right. Something happened starting in the 1980s, and I don't know whether liberals in this country lost heart, lost the fight, lost the whatever, retreated, I don't know why, but I think what happened in large part is also the introduction of more and more money into politics, more and more influence of big money. Basically, we've got a system today where our legislators, whether they're Republicans or Democrats, are basically telemarketers. They spend most of their days dialing for dollars. That's just the sick reality of our political system. And obviously, the plutocrats have more money than the average folk. And once the Supreme Court equated money with votes, it's been downhill ever since for American democracy. So how do you rectify that?
Well, I mean, you know, we've got to get rid of Citizens United. And the only way to do that is to win back power on the Supreme Court. I could see a scenario where there's a vacancy waiting for the next Democratic president, you know, particularly if the Democrats take the Senate in November. And that might mean just, you know, filling that seat, and then we have a 5-4 sort of liberal majority on the court that might be willing to overturn Citizens United if we run a case back up to the Supreme Court. It could be that simple. It might not be that simple, right, if there's a 5-4 or even a 6-3 conservative majority by that point. And to me, that requires packing the courts and then overturning Citizens United on that basis. But, you know, Citizens United is not the only problem with the campaign finance system in this country. That is, would have been multiple efforts since the 1970s to bring some sanity to the way that we fund our elections. And those efforts have all failed or been reversed, including McCain-Feingold from 2002. So I think there's a real opportunity for the next Democratic government in D.C. to really do something meaningful about that by passing a new law that would require public financing of elections, that would restrict the ability of these wealthy people to just, you know, donate limitless sums of cash to the nearest, like, anodyne named a group like Americans for America or whatever it is. I think that we have to fight fire with fire here because we've seen again and again, even in state legislative races, that this infusion of cash from the outside, from the Koch brothers or from whoever, has flipped race after race after race. And we're not going to be the party of wealth. You know, we have to bring some more fairness to that system. But to me, that means, you know, we have to fight from behind here. We have to win a couple of elections in a row. And then we need to play hardball once we get into power.
Well, David Farris, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on the show. It's been a pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with David Farris, who's a professor of political science at Roosevelt University in Chicago and a regular contributor to The Week. He's the author of Dissent and Revolution in a Digital Age, Social Media, Blogging and Activism in Egypt, and co-editor of Social Media in Iran, Politics and Society after 2009. And his latest book just out is It's Time to Fight Dirty, How Democrats Can Build a Lasting Majority in American Politics. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.